The nurse who has one of the shifts watching over Leroy, could you tell us about her, what her situation is? And because she has a very demanding father and she has an interesting background and just a very beautiful person.
Yeah, Pauline I is a woman who was raised by a mentally ill father. And so she's built, like you do in those situations, she's built a maze of walls around herself to protect herself. But sometimes when you do that, you lose your humanity too. And I think she's kind of isolated herself when we first meet her. I could read a section about her that kind of tells you the way she was raised. Even though she had desperately wanted to, Pauline had never run away from home. Her mother had left them when she was 7, and Pauline was forced to live alone with her father until she was 18. He had worked a graveyard shift at a warehouse driving a forklift. He would sleep during the day, and he would yell at her if she was too loud or woke him up. Even as a child, she had to beg him to go to the grocery store and beg him for money for clothes and things she needed at school. There would be days when he would hardly speak to her, and a week when he might not even shower. No one explained to her that her father was mentally ill. She had to learn it herself. She had to navigate it alone. She'd become friends with a girl across the street, Cheryl Wheeler. From age 12 to 18, she ate most of her dinners there at Cheryl's house with her family. When she turned 15, Cheryl's father hired her to work at his dental office, cleaning on Friday nights and doing secretarial work on Saturdays. She saved what money she could and dreamed of escape. As the years passed, her father's moods seemed to grow worse. They became poisonous snakes she had to jump over daily. He would pick on her. He would say cruel things to her. He would make fun of her weight or her appearance or her intelligence. One day he would blame her for what he considered his failure of a life. And then he'd wake her up in the middle of the night and tell her how smart she was, how the whole world was meaningless except for her. He would forget her birthdays. And for Christmas, he would buy her a wrong-sized Snoopy sweatshirt or a Frisbee or a board game, Candyland, Monopoly, or Risk. He would be excessively miserly. And then for no reason or occasion, he would buy her an expensive gift. Once a watch and another time earrings, both of which she really liked. None of it made sense. It just exhausted her. And then 2 weeks before she left for college in Spokane, she came home from a shift at Sherry's restaurant to find a used Ford Focus in the driveway. Her father had saved 2 years for it, a car for her to drive to college in. She would have student loans for 17 years, but she had a car. Her whole life she felt both hatred and empathy for him, and in the end only an inescapable responsibility, a vague duty she couldn't quite understand. The day she left in her new car with all her belongings packed inside, he stayed on the cot in front of the TV, saying nothing. After that day, she would visit him, but never again did she stay more than a night there, and never once did she let him see inside her apartment or any place she ever lived.
Yes, saintly, to say the least. Now, dealing with a bipolar person is really draining because it's like pull and push, just constant.
Yeah, I always felt like it, the rules change daily, but it's always the same game. But then the game suddenly changes, but it's always the same game. It just appears different. So it just wears you out. And I think for her, her answer to it was to build these walls around herself and protect herself. But yet, but it's her father too, so she can't abandon him. Right. And she's kind of stuck with him, and she knows it. So she tries to take care of him, but it's tricky. He's tricky. And I think she does the best she can. Like most people just do the best they can in situations like that.
I'd like to hear about Pauline's protection and care about Joe or Carol, the young girl. Maybe read a little bit about how she first appears in the book, in bed, sick.
Sure. The character who we meet first is Joe, and then you find out her real name is Carol. Really, I wanted to write about her as I've written about similar kids, and Charlie Thompson and the girl he meets, Ruby, and Lean on Pete. Joe is kind of left alone, set adrift. She's from a really religious family, and she goes against them and ends up on the streets. And when we first meet her, She's in the hospital. She's a street kid that's has abscesses from being a junkie. And I think Pauline sees herself in this kid. This is a really good kid that just got in over her head. And I think Pauline sees that. And so Pauline either breaks down all her walls to get to Joe, or Joe jumps all over all her walls. And so I think Pauline tries to save the kid. And by doing so, I think she admits that she needs contact with people, that isolating herself isn't enough to get through her life. By isolating herself more, she's actually killing herself. And so I think Pauline realizes that she has to be a part of the world. And so this is a small scene that describes a meeting between Joe, the kid, and the nurse Pauline, and the kid has just ended up back on her floor. Joe tried to smile, but her face was sunken with worry. "You're going to be okay," Pauline said, and looked at the girl alone in the bed. "But what am I going to do now?" "You're going to get better," Pauline said. "But where am I going to go after that?" "You can't worry about that. You worry about that when you get a little stronger." "But they're going to leave without me," the girl said. Pauline looked out into the hall, saw it empty, and then turned to the girl and whispered, "They were going to let you get sicker and sicker until you died or lost your leg. You have to think about that, because it's true. As much as it hurts to hear, Joe, they don't care about you. They just don't. Look, I know you're alone, but you have to learn how to be all right alone. If you don't, you'll end up in situations like you're in, and you don't deserve that." "But maybe I do deserve it," she said. "You really think so? Maybe. What have you done to deserve living in a freezing house with no water, with three junkie boys who'd use you, who'd rather use you than help you get better?" "Well, I've been pregnant," Joe said quietly and covered her face with her hands.
Yeah, Joe is quite a character. Joe is a good example of how you develop these wonderful characters who are surrounding this vet. You know, you get a very clear picture of these people and what they're dealing with and the burdens they're carrying and whether or not they're able to maintain their dignity. And there's a section where Freddie McCall just collapses. The weight just becomes too much. As you said, the working people will break when the burden gets way too much. And God knows these days in this country, you know, that's the case for a lot of people. And when the breaking point comes, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in, especially in regards to healthcare. You know, I've always worked for myself for the last 15 years or so. And, watching your health insurance go up and up, it almost becomes like a second rent. And then, you know, my girlfriend switched jobs and they didn't have a health plan at her new job. And suddenly she's a, 42-year-old woman that they can't get health insurance and no one will give it to her. And it was those kind of subjects really that got me thinking about the free. Because they're subjects that affect everybody, and they do affect Freddie McCall, even though he does have a health insurance. Just the, trying to find specialists, flying to the specialist with his daughter. I mean, it bankrupts a guy. And then in terms of healthcare, in regards to long-term healthcare, with Darla, the soldier's mom, you know, her life stopped taking care of her son. I think she would feel guilty if she ever had a good time, knowing her son was in a group home and with a brain that would have great moments of despair, as well as Pauline, and whose dad you met earlier, who she's kind of handcuffed to her dad in a way, and it's those kind of issues that you know were the reasons I started the free.
This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO FM. Talking with Willie Vlauten about his latest book titled The Free. I sort of interpreted the book in one sense as being sort of an editorial on where our society is these days. I mean, you have these wonderful people, I mean, or ordinary people, wonderful ordinary people, who are just being drowned with debt for medical costs or whatever it is. I mean, foreclosures, the whole subprime dilemma that people are living like their whole lives dealing with these kinds of stresses, and to maintain your dignity with all that going on is really amazing. Like Pauline to me is really saintly.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, this book, more than any of my others, was I wrote with a mission. You know, I really, it was one of those books I felt I had to write. I think I wrote it pretty quickly in 6 months and then spent 3 years pretty much nonstop editing it because I wanted it to be as good as it could possibly be. And I wanted to say exactly what I thought I wanted to say. But one of the things it also did is it reminded me about kindness. You know, at times I can get so cynical and dark about things that I can't see my way out of it. And sometimes writing, you know, characters like Pauline and Freddie, they're so kind and they remember kindness and they kind of help rebuild me that way. I think in your day-to-day life, if you meet someone that's just nice to you and doesn't have to be nice to you, it can just change you. It can move your life, you know, an inch in a different direction. And maybe you'll be a better person just because someone was nicer to you that day. You know, just those little acts of kindness, I think, go a long way. And I was trying to remember that in a bigger scale, but also in a smaller scale throughout the free kind of, it kind of just channels those ideas of kindness.
When we were talking earlier, you contrasted the very real kindness of Pauline with Joe, the young girl's parents who were Bible thumpers.
Yeah, I was really interested in the idea of what it means to be a Christian. I mean, obviously that's such a heated discussion in America. In my personal experience, the guys that found God, you know, the born again kind of people I've met in my life, they seem to wear more or less, and obviously this is a huge generalization, wear their religion with boxing gloves, you know, they wear it with a badge, and where I think at times the kindness of people that don't wear it with boxing gloves and putting others before yourself, those ideas are more Christian, really. So I think in terms of religion, Freddie and Pauline are very kind and follow, you know, the basic rules, I guess, of Christianity, where Carol's parents ostracize her for the sins that she's done, and the lost boss Pat, who's Freddie McCall at the paint store's boss, he wears it like he's in the Elks Club. He wears it like a club and handles it with a club and uses it with a club. And I think, you know, it's sad when people use religion in that way, I think.
Right. Or use people's desperation. Like, he knows what Freddie McCall's situation is, that he's desperate to keep money together so he can pay off his bills, which are largely due to the medical bills for his daughter,
right,
whom he loves. And the owner of the paint shop exploits Freddie's desperation, which is pretty sick.
Yeah, I mean, the character Pat, who's the owner of the paint store, was actually not, I didn't exaggerate him all. He was an old boss of mine, and this was a guy that, you know, ran his father's business into the ground. And at the same time as he did that, he was the most verbally religious person I'd ever met. You know, you'd have to leave the building when Focus on the Family, the religious show with Dr. James Dobson, we'd all have to leave so he could listen to it on speakerphone alone with his wife in the room, which I describe in the book as well. Yet he was the most unempathetic guy. If a guy had a sick child or there was a funeral to attend or a hardship, he was the first guy to tell you you couldn't take a day off for it. So interesting. It was all ideas I was trying to figure out myself, you know.
Tell us who the free are and who Greenloaders are.
A third of the story is in the mind of the soldier, and his idea is first, he feels like he wakes up with clarity one night. He's not sure. His mind always plays tricks on him, but he sees where he's living. He sees he's been in a group home for 8 years, and he's out of this kind of fog. And so his first idea is like, get me out of here. He tries to kill himself. When he fails at that, he says, well, let my mind get me out of here. And what he wants is to take a romantic, you know, getaway adventure with his girlfriend, but his mind won't let him. And so his mind fluctuates between the romance of this adventure and the darker sides of himself. And that's when he comes across this vigilante group called the Free, who are, they decide who's a real American and who's not a real American. And they've figured it out by a vaccination, that if you're weak-hearted, if you're conflicted by things, if you can't believe in something wholeheartedly, then there'll be a mark on you. And then they know they can't trust you. And so the group, the free, goes after the weak people. I mean, it's an exaggeration, obviously. I grew up in an extremely right-wing family where the idea of discussing an issue was unheard of. There was one way to think about things, and there was such hostility and anger that went along with that, that in a way I was trying to just write about that aspect of that, an exaggeration of it, of course, but to write about that side of America, which is very interesting. So that whole science fiction part, or the dream sequence, is all kind of a study in what if you let the people that do have such kind of like boiling anger, what if you let them do what they wanted?
The character surrounding the vet you describe in very effective detail. The vet himself is sort of like something out of Dalton Trumbo. Johnny got his gun. This person who is absolutely disabled, extremely brain traumatized, just sort of this mute existence. And yet there's this, as you describe it, in these bits and pieces during the book, this flow. There's this sort of delirious, as I read it, this sort of delirious dream. And it was fascinating reading. But this, on a social level, just that distinction between, you know, real kindness and a real sense of duty, and trying to do the next right thing versus this huge fascist beast that he was contending with in his... I was interested in the way you were describing that he was in his... mind, even though his body was debilitated, that he was carrying on this struggle, basically with these what the fascists represented. Could you describe that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, part of it was it's the battle within his mind too. I mean, I think everybody has both sides in them. You can be angry. You can go down both holes in it. You can either side on the side of kindness or try and to be a better person than you were, or you can get angry and blame other people, or use violence. I mean, I think that obviously that's in both sides of a person. It's part of being a human, I think. You know, I think with Leroy, he wasn't even a real soldier. He was a National Guard electrician who gets sent over there. And so I think, you know, when he gets hurt, when he gets a brain injury, he comes home, the army, you know, builds him up, takes him over, and when he gets hurt, they stabilize him and they bring him home. And then it's up to the families for care to be advocates for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about that as well in that scene. But really, the dream sequence was a way to both be romantic with his relationship with his girlfriend, but also to talk about, you know, the more hawkish nature of America that got him there in the first place. And I wanted to say, hey, look, you destroyed this guy's romance. You know, I always look at it like Willie Nelson says, you know, 99% of us don't find the right person. And that's why the jukebox is always full of sad songs. And that's why people always listen to sad songs, because 99% of us don't find the right gal. But Leroy did. I think it just was stolen from him. And so I wanted to say that too, to say the tragedy not only is that he's in a group home in a constant fog and his mom's life stopped, but his girlfriend's life stopped too, and you've ruined a great romance, you know. But everybody knows what it's like to take care of someone with a long-term injury or illness. I mean, whether it's your friend or your neighbor or your loved ones. And I really wanted to write about that because I remember I was in Holman's, the bar Holman's, in Portland, and it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I saw the sports and entertainment updates on the TV, and then afterwards there was just a 2-minute segment on brain injuries and soldiers, and I realized just sitting there, and it was a subject I'd followed because it seemed so horrific to me to have a brain injury like that. But when I sat there watching the program, I realized that the paper very seldom talks about it, the wars very often. None of my friends did. We're not a military city, Portland. You know, there's not a military base right here. So you don't have contact with those guys. So I just felt, you know, maybe I'm a fool, but I felt a great shame in myself because I didn't even pay attention to, you know, I'm a part of a democracy, you know, and I should feel ashamed and try to help at least discuss, you know, why we're there. But it's so easy not to to think about it or worry about it or take any part of it or blame in it. And so a part of the writing The Free was because I was just ashamed that I never even thought about those guys over there.
I wanted to find out what you're working on now.
That book did about kill me. It about did my head in, and I never worked on anything so hard. You know, I was handcuffed to the mission, really, of it. I really wanted to stay on task. So now I'm working on a novel set in the middle of Nevada about two ranchers that lose their jobs. Like, it's kind of a drifter novel set in Nevada and Arizona. And I'm writing it as a gift to myself for surviving The Free. You know, it started out as kind of a happy-go-lucky modern Western, and now it's turning into a much darker piece. I guess my head just won't let me get away from more serious subjects.
Well, you said you've been doing work with Richmond Fontaine, some things coming up.
Yeah, we're right in the middle of recording a record, and that's going well and really fun. And me and one of the guys from Fontaine started another band, which features a singer from Austin, Texas, named Amy Boone. And the band is called The Delines, and it's kind of late night, kind of soul country. And my big dream in life has always been to hide in the back. And write the songs and, you know, be the workhorse, but be in the dark. Right. So this new band, she's the forefront and she's the main thing, and I love it. So hopefully other people like it too.
Yeah, that sounds terrific. This has been Jay Thiemeyer talking with Willie Vlauten about his latest book titled The Free. And you can go to your local independent bookstore and either buy it if they've got it or order it. He has also written Northline and Motel Life and Lean on Pete, and has written some wonderful stuff with Richmond Fontaine, and they're going to be coming out with an album.
Yeah, probably next year, but we're about in the middle of it right now.
That sounds good.
Hey, Jay, thanks a lot for having me and for reading The Free. I appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it tremendously. It's really nice to meet you and talk to you.
Same.
This has been Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO FM, your alternative grassroots radio station in Portland, Oregon.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Bear Witness, a storytelling night to celebrate the release of Extra Tough No. 6.75, Report from Uyak Bay, Thursday, March 20th, 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. Bear Witness features Vanessa Rennick, Laura Messersmith-Glavin, Mo Baustern, Judith Arcana, and Tim Griffey. Again, that's Thursday, March 20th at 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good people, this is Jamila from Guess Who's Coming to Radio. As you may know, the show has taken a hiatus from being on the air. While I will still be involved in radio, I'm here to welcome the ones who will be there on Thursdays, doing radio, which is positive, aware, and proactive. I thank you all for your support and positive words and energy. And just know that it means a lot to me. Wherever you are, stay focused and keep listening to KBOO, your community radio.
I'm Ren Green, and I'm here with a very special guest today, and we're going to talk about community radio. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Joan Foley, and I'm from Headland Community Radio in Port Headland, West Australia.
And how long has your radio station been in operation?
We've had various sort of entities. We probably started in the 80s when there was no commercial radio available. And then it moved and it got left on hold for a while. And then an Indigenous organisation took it over and they ran it for a couple of years and then ended up going bankrupt. And then over the last 8 years, we put ourselves together and have been running it since then.
Now, you just said there was no commercial radio where you are. Describe where your station is, because you're in the middle of nowhere.
I'm in the bush, mate.
You're in Western Australia.
I'm in Western Australia. I suppose listeners might be aware of Broome, if they're aware of anywhere in Western Australia, and Perth. So we're 600 kilometres south of Broome, just where the desert meets the sea, really.
So you are, I guess, in the upper left of Australia, pretty much.
On the Indian Ocean side.
Yeah, okay.
A little bit, the flat bit of, you know, sort of where it flattens out a bit.
There was no radio whatsoever at the time?
ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, they are just about everywhere. So there was ABC, and then there was Northwest Radio that was, I'm pretty sure it was, you know, just put together by locals. And then that became a commercial entity. And so they went again to get this community radio up.
Our community radio station here at KBOO, we are entirely listener supported, and our history, we're 45 years old, and back in the day a group of people decided they wanted to hear classical music on the radio, and that wasn't being supplied here in Portland, although no one plays classical on the station anymore, but that was how we got started.
Well, they morph, don't they?
Yeah, we do. It's an ever-changing landscape. What was the driving force behind the founding of your station?
I think the need for local information. Whenever the Shire, the local government, do surveys, they want, what people want to know is what's happening. And probably that was the key thing, to have a tool to let people know what's happening. Our town is right on a cyclone belt, so we get battered with cyclones on a reasonably frequent basis, probably 2-3 a year. Sometimes they batter, sometimes they just bring rain. But things like that, to know what the cyclones are doing, and just the activities, where you can go in town. We're a very transient town, and we have a big mining industry there. That's what kept us floating while you guys were sinking in 2008. We were riding on the iron ore gravy train, and the iron ore comes from our town. So we have people coming in and out quite frequently, and they want to know what they can do to be part of what's going on in the town. There's kind of like two levels. There's the mining level that runs across at the top, and then there's the real people that my volunteers at the radio station that kind of are down and dirty and involved in all the things that make a town be.
Serving yourselves, basically.
Yeah, trying to let everybody know what activities are, particularly the things that they can do for no cost.
So what format is your station? You public affairs and local news, or what else do you do there?
Well, what they support for community radio is to try and get a little bit of, well, for us as the only community radio in town, like it's different in Perth. You'd have things like, you were set up to do classical music. In Perth, they have various community radios that have, each of them have a different identity, so they might be like an ethnic station or a reading for the print handicap, or, you know, a different setup, or oldies music or 50s music or whatever. For us in Port Hedland, we try and cater for a little bit of each of those things. So we have a Read to Me program where the girl from the library reads a piece, a story, you know, in the mornings. We have a language program for Aboriginal languages, and that's taken up through, there's a system of Aboriginal stations that are in our area and north in the more isolated areas where there's individual pockets of Indigenous people living. They all have different languages, and they get to keep their languages alive with community radio. And so this program is taken up in their programming, and then they also have each individual Indigenous community does an hour or so in their town or their community of their particular language. So that's important. And the other things we do is notify of changes of road conditions, fires, floods. We do all of those. It's land of flooding rains and, you know, fires and all that. And then just like general music programs. Country's very popular, and I've finally got a couple of blokes doing a country show, got a blues show, and the blues fitted into a genre that where a time slot that other stations had blues in that spot. So now they take up our blues show up to Broome and across the country, anybody that sort of likes it. It's just, and then we do Monday mornings and Friday mornings. Monday mornings I do, and Friday mornings there's another ladies from the Well Women's Centre where we do a whole hour of what's going on in town. Bit of our opinions as well sometimes.
Do you broadcast 24/7?
We do, with the aid of, you know, the wonderful computers and what have you, and pre-recording and all of that, but we don't have live broadcasters every all day, but
neither do we.
It's pretty hard to do. We do. It's part of our licensing requirements.
Tell us about radio licensing in Australia. What's the process?
We have the ACMA, which is a national body that licenses everything that goes on the airwaves. So they do television, they do radio, they do short bandwidths, like for organisations that are talking to truckies or on the mines or whatever. All of that has to go through the ACMA, and they have maps of what bandwaves are being used. Then for us as a community radio, we have to find, if you were starting up, you'd have to find a bandwidth that's free and then apply to them to be able to use it, say what your support was going to be and all that. And then our license that we are using is still temporary. You have to prove to them that you're moving forward, that you've got all the things that are required before they'll give you a permanent